So science is not as neutral as we know it is. There are politics as well, which is at play, and we must neutralize that well to bring in especially the true color of the science in terms of who's been affected, how are they being affected, and what should be done for them.
That was Dr. Anjal Prakash, Research Director and Adjunct Associate Professor, Bharti Institute of Public Policy at ISB. His work primarily focuses on water and climate change, urban resilience, and gender and social inclusion issues in South Asia.
Faculty Cast is a podcast series by ISB Executive Education. The podcast features ISB professors who continue to broaden the horizons of new knowledge. Through this podcast series, we hope you gain research-backed perspectives on complex challenges to manage and lead effectively.
Greetings, listeners. It is a pleasure and delight and an honor to be speaking to Professor Anjal Prakash today from ISB. And what we're going to discuss is a very imperative and a critical topic in today's world, because this is something that we've been hearing and it is going to impact us. It is going to impact our future generations as well. So we are talking about climate change and sustainability and the steps that we could take as a nation, as a globe, towards reducing the impact of climate change. So welcome, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, and it's a delight for me to be speaking to you, and wonderful to discuss this topic, which is very topical at this moment for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So I was going through the latest IPCC report, and you know, one was in for a rude shock when I was made aware that the deadline for a climate change of or a temperature change of 1.5 degrees Celsius, we are soon approaching that deadline. And in the light of this urgency, do you think it is fair for developing nations to have the same goals or same aspirations as a developed nation, you know?
Yeah, very good question. The recent IPCC report says that we are going to be approaching 1.5 degree by 2050 itself, if everything remains the way it is at this moment. The 1.5 degree goal was end of century target. Now the goalpost shifted to 2 degree, which climate scientists like us is also visualizing that it's going to go beyond 2 degree because we are not cooperating as coming together. Countries are not coming together. So that's number one. So each fraction of warming actually has an impact on the lives and livelihoods. So the millions of poor, especially people from the global south. Coming to the question of same climate target for the entire world, is something that developing countries have been objecting to. I'll give you some figures which will be interesting for you to note. So, you know, as per 2022 data, 19% of the global north actually has contributed to 68% of historical emission. And 81% of developing nations have contributed only 32% of the emission as per 2022 data. So, you know, when we are not partying to the same level of emission, why are we asked to follow the same deadline as the developed nation? That's number one. By what we call the, you know, developing nations are asking for equitable carbon space. That means that today's climate change actually is a creation of the global north, which are industrialized nations. And then they are actually emitting a lot of carbon in the space, and that creating a causing problem for the people from the global south. So in that sense, if, you know, US and Canada must reach net zero by 2025, not by 2050, as they have mentioned. You know, Germany, for example, has to reach net zero by 2030 and not by 2045, as they have mentioned. And European Union has to reach net zero by 2031 than 2050. China has to reach also net zero by 2031 than 2050. So this part is a contentious topic between global north and the south, but we are galvanizing together, and we are asking for equitable climate space.
Absolutely, Professor. So, and I think in terms of climate change and sustainability, we have to be moving our thinking to one globe rather than one country versus the other. But when you spoke about cooperation, collaboration, all that we understand, but also for the developing nations to be supported financially and technologically, they might not have that many resources because they have aligned certain resources and might not be very sustainable technology and sustainable ways that the way they do work. So how do you think that there can be a balance struck between providing support and also respecting the rights to sustainable development.
So this has been, the matter of debate, because what has happening is that the developed nations who also have the technology to combat climate change, while developing countries, especially countries in the global south, are finding it very difficult to cope with the catastrophe that is caused by climate change. And in the last COP in Sharm el-Sheikh, and unfortunately, I was there in the negotiation, where finally we decided that we will have a loss and damage fund. And that means that the people who have caused climate change must contribute to people who are fighting climate change, who have not contributed an inch to the carbon space that we have. But what developing countries are asking for is the more and more kind of a technology support in terms of finance. Imagine a country like Bhutan, who is actually carbon neutral and carbon negative, has to bear a brunt of climate change. The increasing landslides are happening, floods are coming, happening in Nepal, entire Himalayan region that we see, and they have not contributed an inch to this whole process. And that's why they're asking for more finance to follow, though negotiations are actually finding it very hard to make that them to take this forward.
So yes, Prof, as you mentioned, the global north countries have been contributing more, and the global south or the downstream countries have been impacted disproportionately. So could you cite some recent examples in a country like ours? We are aware we had those glacier lake outburst floods in Sikkim, but what are the other recent examples where countries in the downstream have been impacted negatively?
So there are many, many examples. This year itself has been a very devastating year for globally for people all across different ecologies, if I say. So if you're looking this part of the world where we are in, you have this three major ecologies, the Himalayan region. The second is what we call the coastal areas, and third is the semi-arid regions. But 54% of the entire continent here is actually more than 56-55% is in the arid regions. And that means that each of the ecologies, climate change is impacting very differently. If I look at the Himalayan region, for example, they have increased flood. What you have seen in Sikkim is a reminder for us of what we should not do in those areas, right? So it is climate plus change. It is not only climate change, but the changes which is happening, the infrastructure which has been developed in those regions also have to, especially hydropower, has to be blamed also, apart from the region being so fragile for any small changes which happen in the ecology. Coming to coastal areas, for example, you have increased cyclones. Now we have pre-monsoon cyclones, and every year we'll have 3 to 4 major cyclones hitting the coast. India has about 7,500 kilometers of coastal region, which is being affected by climate change. And semi-arid region, you have seen more and more drought, water scarcity. As we are warming up, the water impounded are also getting evaporated, and people are finding it very difficult to cope with the situation that we have. See, altogether, what we've seen across the world, the seasons have changed totally. Monsoon season, which was actually one of the important season for the entire of especially South Asia, this is totally toppled. When you want rain, the rain will not come. When you don't want, it will pour. And that has toppled the system, because about 60-70% of people are still dependent on agriculture, a sector which is actually on a decline. We have negative growth in agriculture, and that is leading to many people getting impoverished. And then you have seen migrations happening. So from the poorer location where people are more involved in agriculture, and they find it much more stressful, and they are migrating to urban cities and then flocking to cities. And so this is the entire ecological systems as well as sociological systems are being toppled by climate change.
And if I could add another point to that, there are medical implications. We are spending a lot more on our healthcare because we are impacted by climate change. Absolutely. The viral infections that we are seeing in various countries, which are going haywire.
That's true. So among humans also, we have seen many new diseases which has come up, which we scientists are not finding it. And they're taking time to understand what kind of a disease it is. And also in the agriculture systems, there are new pests which has happened, and farmers are finding it very difficult. So it's affecting the crops much more. As we are warming up also in some areas which used to be snow-clad, for example, earlier, now we have barren land. And the Glof example that we've seen in Sikkim is one of the reasons what has happened. happened. So I'll explain to you what, you know, exactly happened in Sikkim, which will give us a little context of how changing climate is impacting the life. So in the upper reaches of Teesta, and I had the fortune to do a lot of field work in the upper reaches of Teesta, and these are very thinly populated region, but they have a lot of lofts there. The glacier lakes, which is because of climate change, the glaciers are melting and they're finding it ditches to get water impounded. So instead of snow, you have more and more water impounded in the upstream. And little change, you know, small seismic activity or small crack in those lakes will throw water downstream without much of a warning, because we don't monitor most of these lakes. There are about 266 such lakes in the upper reaches of Teesta. And one of them actually breached, and this devastation that we have seen, you know, estimates are saying that 25,000 crores of hydropower has just been washed away with one rain, which has happened in the upstream areas, or one crack which has happened in the Gulf. So this is going to be the order of the day. What we call it's a new normal, and how do we cope with it is a question.
Yes, Prof. I think we saw another example of this in Uttarakhand in 2021, the National Thermal Power Corporation hydropower project got washed away in that.
Yeah. The Chamoli disaster, for example, which is a similar thing which has happened. So Chamoli is another interesting, way in which we know how climate change is impacting our lives. So in the month of February, in the upper reaches of the river, which was actually a time when the mass balance in the glaciers gets impacted because there's more and more snow which happens. So suddenly what happened is that there was a week of huge snowfall, and the snow was settling on the glaciers. Suddenly there was one bright day, which is unprecedented, never happened in the point of history. And then the entire glacier, a big chunk of glacier actually broken off from the glacier, and then it started to flow downstream. And that has led to what we call the Chamoli disaster, which is again, we are caught off guard because we are not monitoring most of these areas. We are having problems in terms of how do we cope with such sudden changes in the environment and leading to catastrophes that we have seen and affecting lives of the millions of people that we have in the region.
So Prof, when we always say that human spirit is indomitable, we always say, okay, what's been done has been done. Let us move forward. So if we are moving towards a low carbon economy, it will present a lot of opportunities and also a lot of challenges for developing nations. So what are some of these opportunities and also challenges in your view?
Yeah. So first of all, we have to understand what is the model of development that we are following. So in the West, what they followed, that they developed themselves in the process of development, they put in a lot of carbon in the air. They polluted it and then tried to fix the problem, right? And to the level that they have developed, that has happened for them, fixing the environment, building resilient communities are not very difficult because they already had a lot of money to do that. If we follow the same development process in the global south, develop, pollute and try to fix it, we don't have that option because we have breached many of the climatic boundaries. Out of 9 boundaries, 4 boundaries have already been breached. That means we don't have that option. We have to go through what we call the low carbon economy process because we cannot develop and also pollute the environment because that option, as I said, is not there. So how do we do that is a $1 million question. And the problem is that we are still aping the West. We are still thinking that the model of development that the West has is the model, and we're not reinventing how we can develop and still protect our environment. And that is something that Indian civilization has actually taught us for a long time. This whole phrase which is picked up by the Ministry of Environment, Forest and Climate Change is Prakriti Rakshite Rakshita. If you protect the Prakriti, which is the nature will protect you, right? This kind of symbiotic relationship which we had with nature is something that we have to bring it back in our discussions and then take it forward to this one. We also have millions of people to feed. 400, 500 million people who are living below $2 a day. These people also need to be fed. So it's not easy for us to think about environment at the same time also not developed. So we need to bring in basic infrastructure like health, education, roads to these people. Same time, we also have to see how can we bring development which is environmentally benign and helps them in the process. And there are many, many models which exist. We can talk about it later in probably the next podcast.
Surely, but this gives a very good perspective that there are challenges, but there are also opportunities for countries like us to start with a fresh thinking, start from ground zero and set examples of sustainable living.
Yeah, I always say, and you know that when I teach sustainability in the class, I always say that climate change, don't take it as a negative thing, take it as a positive, because every problem has an opportunity. And that is what I see, that the opportunities are huge to follow a green growth pattern. We also have green jobs, which are new kind of a job, which is emerging. People have to tune into those new changes. And as fast as we are able to tap on to those changes, we will be able to develop much further, in a sense that we protect the environment, at the same time we are also developing and bringing people out of poverty. One of the things that we have seen is the corporates are doing much better jobs. You know, whenever the problem exists, I think corporate India or otherwise in the world have come out with the solution. And then there are many solutions, as I teach in the class, which exist already. Which makes us go green and still be benefited by the process. So bringing sustainability is not a negative thing. It is actually positive. It brings you profit. It protects the planet and also it takes care of the people. So the three P's that we talk about, people, planet and profit, it is all in harmony and in the way which we can keep balance between all the three P's.
Sure, Prof. So, while I understand that the corporates are doing a lot, and when we are talking of one globe, one earth, all of us living as global citizens, then do you think there are some international climate finance institutions who will play a role in helping the developing nations, and how could they do that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. See, climate finance has been one of the contentious point of discussions in all the global negotiations. And I've been party to some of the negotiations where things that IPCC report has been brought out, there's a huge gap in the demand that we have. So you have the demand and the supply. The demand coming from, especially from countries of the global south, which is facing a problem. The supply should come from nations who have contributed to the climate change process. And that's negotiation, which is contentious most of the time. But thankfully, this last COP that we have, the Loss and Damage Fund, and the details are going to be following forward. The financial institutions, actually, in my personal view, have not done as much as they should have, because they're still controlled by the global north. So the narrative has been built by them. The execution of the finance has also been, is in the control of the global north. This must change. And that's what I think India has a lot of, and I've seen India growing up to be the leader of the global south. They're putting people together and negotiating with the global north in some of these negotiations. And that is something is a very sea change in India's strategy, what I've seen. So, India has to follow its size that we have, right? So we think we still feel that there's a lot that India can do to lead this process.
So is the primary ask of India is equity and inclusivity, or there are certain other asks which India has put on the table for the developing or for the developed nations?
So if nowadays, when the narrative has been built by the global north, they said, who are the most three polluted countries? And China and India comes in the second and third. USA and then India is the third largest polluter at this moment. But if you look at the per capita pollution, especially carbon emission, we are one of the lowest in the world. We have 1.7 ton, which is almost close to sub-Saharan Africa, which is 0.7 ton. When you look at China, you look at USA, it is 15, 13, 14 tons per capita, which is huge. The gap is huge. So we are saying that, we are still a low carbon economy and we still have the space to grow. At the same time, we also want to be equitable. So India's ask is definitely of a more equitable world. And that's why it's important to change the narrative. And as you know, that most of the time, the scientific institutions are also headed by people from the global north. And that's where the whole issues of difference of perspective also comes in. We are there. We are not large in number, but we are making the point. And I think we are being also heard by the community at large. And that's the progress, I would say, India has brought in.
So while India is a large country, there might be smaller developing nations, Professor, who might be very concerned about their ambitious climate change action, which is expected from them. And also, how does it impact positively or negatively their economic development? So how do you think these concerns should be addressed to bring them at par?
Yeah. So this whole concept of global north versus global south has been coined to bring in these issues on board, especially, for example, small island nations, right? Like Maldives, you have Fiji Island, you have now numerous of them existing. The way in which we are warming up and the sea level is rising, they may not exist by end of the century. And that's something that is appalling for people because, and they're also facing the wrath of the climate change because increasingly these in Arabian Sea, for example, or in the Bay of Bengal, you have huge depression, which is leading to catastrophic events, especially in terms of the cyclones that has been there for them. And it's affecting lives of the people day in and day out. So small island nations have come up as a group, and then they've all been advocating for things. Global South concept has been brought in by many people, and India has joined the bandwagon to lead some of the discussions. And also the scientists of the Global South are coming together. I know being part of some groups where we are also voicing opinion within IPCC. I've been one of the authors of IPCC, and we are voicing in our opinions, which may be different from the scientists of the Global North. So science is not as neutral as we know it is. There are politics as well, which is at play, and we must neutralize that as well to bring in especially the true color of the science in terms of who's been affected, how are they being affected, and what should be done for them.
Thank you, Professor. You've given me so many new perspectives. Personally, so many things I did not know about. But some last top of the chart points that you would want to leave our listeners with. We at a personal level, how can we be more mindful? How can we have a more sustainable way of living? Because what happens at the country level, at a globe level, is our policy processes, and they'll take time to percolate. But we as individuals, how can we contribute?
Yeah, that's a very good question that you asked. And let me end it. See, when I said, India's carbon footprint is per capita is 1.7 tons, but it's the Indian the average of 1.4 billion people. About 400 to 500 million people in India has a similar lifestyle as you have it in the West. And that means the mindfulness about the consumption pattern that we have, small issues in terms of, very small thing about how do we protect nature, what do we do to protect water scarcities, at least not waste water, mindless kind of consumption pattern that we have in terms of eating food, the food habits that we've been changing for the teenagers, the kind of clothes that we buy and we don't recycling them. I remember my grandmother used to, we never used to have those time polythene bags, the plastic polythene bag. I remember my grandmother and mother used to stitch old jeans into a bag, and we used to take that bag to buy stuff. Now those days are all over, but we now have to bring it back. So some of these, conservation, which is very much ingrained in the Indian ethos and the what we call the culture that we have, we must protect that. We have been losing that, actually. So it's our responsibility to teach this to our younger children, younger generation.
Thank you so much, Professor. It has been a pleasure and also a very good learning experience for me personally, having this interaction with you today.
This is an absolute pleasure for me to talk to you and also to your listeners. I'm sure this podcast is going to be listened by many, many people. And I wish all of you all the best. And I hope some small measures in which we can actually bring in sustainability in our daily lives is going to make a lot of change for us. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Professor.